on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for Tuesday, February 3rd, 2009. Welcome. We are going to take the bills out of order today to accommodate some scheduling issues. Just so you know, we'll be doing 145, Senate Bill 145, and then Senate Bill 141, and then Senate Bill 188. I'd like to remind you to turn off cell phones, BlackBerries, PDAs. I know it's very difficult to disconnect from the electronic world, but the devices do interfere with our sound recording equipment. So thank you very much for honoring that request. I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 145 and ask our committee administrator to summarize the bill, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 145 authorizes the Board of Geologist Examiners to investigate complaints. It allows board members or employees or agents of that board to exercise certain investigative powers and provides immunity for persons who are not subject of a complaint to make a complaint, testify as a witness, act as a technical reviewer, or provide information as long as those actions are made in good faith. It grants immunity to board members, employees, technical reviewers, agents, and attorneys for official actions. It allows the board to appoint registered geologists to perform services for the board, and it also validates prior appointments of registered geologists who have performed services for the board. It also makes some technical revisions.
Thank you very much. And our list for people who are here to testify today on Senate Bill 145. First, I would like to ask the proponents, Steve Taylor, Dr. Taylor, and Susanna Knight, please. Thank you. Welcome, and if you'll please introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Is it on?
Yes.
My name is Susanna Knight. I serve as administrator for the State Board of Geologist Examiners. I reside at 237 Marcourt in Monmouth, Oregon.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for your time this afternoon. My name is Steve Taylor. I'm currently serving as chair of the Oregon State Board of Geologist Examiners, and I am a registered professional geologist as well as a faculty member and professor of geology at Western Oregon University. I live in Corvallis, 2575 Southeast Courier Street, and work in Monmouth.
Thank you. Have you decided who's going to be speaking first?
Yeah, I'll take the first turn.
All right, Dr. Knight. Dr. Taylor. Sorry.
I defer to the boss.
Who's going first?
Thank you. I will go first because I wanted to just make a couple comments, committee, about the makeup of the board. The Oregon State Board of Geologists has been in existence since 1978. It has five members appointed by the governor, four are registrants, and one is a public member. And then the state geologist serves as the ex officio member of the board. And I've just presented a small statement for you. I did forward something late yesterday afternoon via email in case you had a moment of time before today to look at it. And Dr. Taylor is going to talk to you today about the essence of the bill.
Thank you very much. Okay. Dr. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. We have about 1,200 registrants, and I have this summarized on our one-page summary sheet. We have about 1,200 registrants, and we are professional geologists and certified engineering geologists. We practice publicly for state, federal agencies, as well as private individuals. Most of our consultants and practitioners are working in the area of land stability and water resource issues, primarily in the western part of the state, where the greatest population density. We are very similar in scope of practice and style of practice to that of the engineering profession. We handle our board is charged in part with public outreach as well as handling compliance cases from within our registrant pool, and we handle anywhere on average of about 9 to 10 compliance cases per year, ranging from complaints of practice without a license to poor quality workmanship. Our range of actions, potential compliance actions, include letters of concern and working with our registrants as part of an outreach effort, and leading up to in more significant cases to revocation of a license, and we do have some civil penalty authority. Compliance process involves volunteers. Our board is a volunteer board, and with a paid staff. And our compliance process involves volunteers who serve as technical reviewers, working in concert with the board to investigate cases. And we have a procedural process that we go through with a compliance committee, a chair of the committee, and we proceed with investigations. What this bill does for us primarily is take the language from that was enacted in 1977 to take the language, and over time we have tested our law, and what we're trying to do is clarify the language, make it more explicit to empower the board, to get the explicit language to empower the board to investigate compliance cases, and which we do in practice and in principle, but the language is not as explicit as it should be. And then part two is to provide some type of immunity clause to protect our volunteers from retaliatory action from our respondents. There is precedence for this in other licensing boards in the state. At the bottom of the page, on my one-page handout, there is a list of the statutes and the boards, licensing boards, who have this type of language in their laws. And we would like to bring our laws more up to date and in line with some of the other licensing boards in the state.
Thank you. Committee members? Yes, I see Senator Girard has a question.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. Could you kind of give me a scope of some of the ideas about where a complaint might be filed and what might be the conflict in that complaint?
You mean in terms how what
well,
the process is?
Well, no, not the process. More specifically, the complaint. I know that it has to, you're talking that there might be some disagreement in scope. And, you know, the fear would be that you don't allow enough latitude so that there can be disagreement on the board. And so I just was kind of curious as to you say you have 10 complaints per year or that about. Give me an example. You don't need to name names or anything, but what, you know, some examples of what that might entail.
Of the types of complaints?
Yeah, well, say on shoddy opinions or something. What? I know you talked about land stability, but that's more of an engineer. For me, I would think that would be more of an engineer's.
There's a line between engineering and geology, and it mm-hmm. certainly crosses over. But a good example would be, for example, property development in rural areas that are off of public water supplies, where there are water wells involved. Mm-hmm. Developers, depending on where you are in the state, there are local codes that provide for homeowners or developers to establish that there will be enough groundwater for use if there's a well system mm-hmm. put in for that particular member of the community. We, of course, have ethical issues because then those persons then would need to hire or engage the services of a hydrogeologist, which is that type of geologist that works in that area. And then there is a report, technical report provided. And so in some cases, well, for one thing, one of the obvious things is practicing without a license, because we do have laws that require a license. And then in other issues, we have there have been complaints from both from clients and other consultants, as well as from state and county agencies, of poor quality workmanship. So those are the sources of complaints, both from within our ranks, from government agencies, as well as from clients.
Okay. Can I have a follow-up, please?
Yes.
Okay, to use your example on the well water, say that you had two geologists that were had opposing views. I mean, could one then file a complaint against the other and say it was poor workmanship, and then you would have to make a determination? Or is there some latitude here?
Yeah, since Susanna actually is our administrator and she handles the nuts and bolts of these types of issues, mm-hmm. she could respond to that.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, in that case, if we have two reports and we get a complaint, it's usually from a citizen who's unhappy with the content of a report. And that's where we engage technical reviewers from the region that would understand the geology and understand the practice. And then they would evaluate the geology as it's presented presented and come to a conclusion to help the compliance committee evaluate if the report correctly represented the geology.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, I'm not by any means an expert on geology, but I have had some geologists who live in my district attend town halls, and I know from just their comments that some of the things geologists do survey and assess is earthquake hazard, tsunami hazard, things like that. So I would assume that if you have somebody practicing without a license, you could put the public at pretty serious risk if you have somebody without proper credentials. Are there, I mean, do you get some cases like that?
Yes, and the way the law is written, it's to protect the health, welfare, and safety of the citizens of Oregon, and not only the citizens, but the environment as well.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking of another board in the state where it is sort of the industry reviewing itself, and in an industry where you have about 1,200 members, everybody pretty much knows each other, knows the players. And what happens in this other board that I'm thinking of is there starts to be political parties within those boards, and they view that the regulatory action that you're asking to be granted here is used against them politically rather than on. Because a lot of it's subjective, and a lot of your work is subjective. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned at all? I mean, I guess my concern is that this could be used as a punitive action against certain people that may not agree with the majority of the geologists in the industry. And I just kind of want to get your response, because it seems like to me it makes me nervous when we have a small industry regulating itself because it's peer review, and it could politics enter in really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator George, in my experience, and I've been here 10 years, we've had little political involvement in that way. And when technical reviewers come forward to help us, they haven't had knowledge of the individual that they're peer reviewing. And we haven't had too much of a problem with that. And especially not in the political arena. Other than when the board did take action, and this was maybe 8 years ago, you know, a constituent went to his senator and another constituent went to his senator because they weren't happy with what the board did. And we did sit down with the senators to explain to them that what we were doing, that was it.
Quick follow-up?
Yes, go ahead.
I was noticing that in your testimony you talk about the fact that you guys did revoke three licenses between 98 and 2006 and then issued civil penalties. So what additional power, I mean, because that's, you know, obviously, that's a significant number out of 1,200, I mean, to actually have a license revoked. What additional power are you asking for that's not included in your ability to revoke licenses and assign civil penalties? What's the difference? What's the nuanced difference between this new process being proposed and the existing process?
My understanding, of course, this is with discussions with our legal counsel. My understanding is that our language is not as explicit as it could be with the word or the term empower. And we have been conducting these compliance cases, and we have the implicit and from a practical standpoint, the process for investigating. So this is kind of a tightening of the language. My understanding of that part of it is, and then the immunity part is just, again, to kind of match existing practice with other boards and or licensing boards.
Thank you. You're welcome. And I had a couple of questions. Thank you very much. I wanted to clarify something that we had talked about when we met and kind of get this on the record. I noticed when we were talking previously that the Section 3 of the bill on the first page says that the board shall consist of four geologists and one public member appointed by the governor. And then on the back side of the bill, it says that the state geologist shall be an ex officio member of the board. So to me, it wasn't clear from reading that if the board consists of five people or six people, and that I don't think is clear from the way it's worded, and just wondered if that is something that could be clarified while you're going through this process. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, we after meeting with you last week, we discussed that not only amongst ourselves, Susanna and myself, but also with the state geologist to get her opinion about kind of the history of that. And we agree that the language is not as clear as it could be, and that we have five voting members and then one non-voting ex officio member who will be represented by as a state geologist. So we were in agreement with your assessment after we met with you the other day that that language could be tightened and more clarifying than it is.
Thank you. And the four geologists and one public member are all appointed by the governor, or the public member is appointed by the governor?
Madam Chair, all five members are appointed by the governor.
Thank you. And then I also wanted to ask about the immunity section in Section 2, Paragraph 2. I've been trying to look at some of the other sections that you have cited in the letter that you submitted to compare those. Do you happen to know if there was a particular model for that? Because I haven't seen some of the same language in the others, although I've done just a cursory review.
I have to think on that for a second. Madam Chair, I know that our attorney was also the attorney for, like, Board of Nursing and another one of the OSHA boards, and he helped craft the language for that. And I think that he, you know, reflected on his time with those boards and how language was written. But I can follow up on that and get that information to you.
I think that would be helpful because I know there are some concerns that have been raised about some of the language in here, and I think we'll be hearing from at least one person about the scope of the immunity. And some of the immunity, I think, only applies to people who come to testify before the board rather than the board members themselves. But I haven't been able to confirm that in the short time that I've been looking at these. So we may want to get some more information about that. Any other questions from the committee members? Okay, it looks like we'll be working on it, at least one amendment to this before we move it out. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we also have Andrea Meyer.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon. I am here to raise some concerns about the language in Section 2 and Section 4 because of its broad nature, and I, too, was quickly trying to look at the examples provided. It does appear that the various other agencies, the language is all over the place in terms of what type of language is used and whether there's a model. I certainly did not do an exhaustive research, but the only one that I found providing criminal immunity related to health licensing, ORS 676, 170, and 280, and if I can get this correctly because I don't have it in front of me, I think that's a duty for healthcare providers to notify law enforcement if they think there's a car accident related to with the blood alcohol is high, that there's a duty, that there was alcohol involved, and they have immunity if in providing the notice to law enforcement, but I have not done an exhaustive even review of that. Oh, so overall, I have significant concerns about giving sort of this broad-based level of immunity for every type of situation here. Some of these other agencies, it appears giving a report or making complaint, there is some civil immunity provided for good faith. I'm not sure where we would go with criminal immunity and why it would be okay except if it was perjury. And I assume I would be reading this to the extreme, and I assume it may not cover this, but if I was testifying as a witness before the board and in good faith I just provided information about a criminal activity that I had done, would I be granted immunity to that information that I engaged in that crime unrelated to perjury or even that board? Raise that simply as I have concerns about the language. So we would hope that would be at the minimum greatly limited, removing criminal action immunity, narrowing it down to civil, looking at some other boards. I'm not sure about the language in Section 2, Sub 3 regarding the immunity to board members that goes beyond the immunity that they otherwise have by law, and expanding to the same privileges and immunities from civil and criminal proceedings arising out of their official actions as do prosecuting attorneys and judicial officers of the state. I don't know why that language is there, what the reason is, and what protections that would provide, and if that's commonly used elsewhere in these licensing boards.
finally, I think I misspoke. It was Section 5 at the end. This would apply to actions taken before, on, or after the effective date. So this would apply retroactively, and I just wanted to issue spot that as well. So with that very cogent testimony, I would be happy to answer any questions, but I hope this would be greatly narrowed if it proceeds forward.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Meyer?
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Senator Burdick. I guess I'd like to ask a question to the board in light of this testimony about why the immunity was made retroactively.
Okay, we can ask them to come up, but before then, do we have questions for Ms. Meyer? Senator George, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andrea, as I read this, basically you could get up in a committee meeting and completely slander somebody and you'd be protected?
If you engage in slander or defamation or whatever is currently protected in Oregon law, if they have immunity, right, I guess that would provide them immunity under that. Sorry, I first misunderstood your question, Senator George and Chair Bonamici. Yes, it seems that if you were acting in good faith, you would be protected and immune from any civil action arising for damages arising from your testimony at that meeting or hearing.
Can I follow you up?
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
And so, because it's retroactive, anything you might have said at any time in the past from childhood also would be immune, correct? And your reading?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick.
I know there's statutes of limitations.
Right. I suspect there's not a huge concern for a retroactive. I just raise that. I do want to, and yes, I think it's just so broad that we don't know what it would encompass. And again, someone acting in good faith very narrowly with some immunity. The other thing I want to bring to your attention, and I failed to do that a moment ago, was that sometimes when people do testify or speak at a hearing like this or testify before government agencies, they're worried about engaging in their free expression being sued. And there is what we call the SLAPP law, which is ORS 31.150. I'm sure the chair could actually speak to this better than I'm about to, but it basically provides that if you're sued civilly for engaging in First Amendment free speech activity, if you guys went after me for testifying today, I could move to strike this underlying civil action because you're going after me in a manner that might be intimidating for me exercising my free speech, not to personalize this in any way. So there is a protection against if someone's testifying in good faith and they're worried that someone could go after them for what they said to try to intimidate or chill their free speech. But likewise, if I get up and defame or break civil law in testifying, I would hate for there to be protection there as well.
And I might add that SLAPP is an acronym.
Yes. and yet it's under the ORS, which says special motion to strike, which does not get us to SLAPP. Right. Special law against public.
Strategic loss
against public participation.
Senator Burdick, did you have a question?
No, I just wanted to tell you what the acronym meant.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
one
thing that I also wanted to mention is with regard to the section that talks about perjury. I know there was a concern raised that sometimes it isn't perjury that's the issue, it's false swearing statute. So I just wanted to put that on the record that's something that should be considered when looking at the other than for perjury language. Are there any other questions for Ms. Meyer? And then I'm going to ask Ms. Knight and Dr. Taylor to come back up if they could. I think Dr. Taylor had to go, but Ms. Knight is here. Because Senator Burdick had a question in light of the recent testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was, why is this immunity retroactive, and it's quite broad. I'm just wondering whether you based it on some other agency or why the need for retroactivity?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, that was placed in there for purposes of protecting those folks that have served as technical reviewers over the past 10 years or prior to the time that the bill would become effective.
And has there been a problem? Are they being sued, or what's the problem we're addressing here?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, we are trying to avoid having a problem.
But
there have been sniffs of this, and folks that have volunteered and to help us with the regulatory and have had an occasion where someone is going to go back and try to dig up things so that they can put complaints in against them.
Madam Chair, sometimes when I look at a bill like this, I wonder what the backstory is.
Right.
You know, what's going on out there that that led to this? And so far I haven't heard anything specific, any specific problem that this is addressing.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I don't think that we want to address if there's a specific problem. What we would like to do is prevent this from happening so that we can continue to have people that are willing to volunteer for us. And when I was chatting with some of my volunteers recently, they just assumed that they had some kind of protection because they're serving as volunteers for the board. They were surprised they didn't have some kind of protection for the work they do as a volunteer.
Never knew there was this much drama, Ms. Madam Chair, in the world of geography, geology.
Senator Gerard.
I kind of like to follow up with what Senator George was saying and some of the other things, and that is my concern with giving you such broad power is the political arena. Specifically, in your specific arena, it's growth versus anti-growth. And you give professional testimony of which it's real common to have two geologists that don't agree. And I want to make sure that if we give you this wide sweeping power, that one side does not take precedent over the other. And that's my concerns with giving you this much power in this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And until I get those questions answered, I can't support it. But is there anything in there that supports, you know, the fact that people can give their honest opinion and that there can be disagreement in your community of which they then don't make themselves prone to losing their license?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, that is not the intent of what this bill is supposed to do. It's supposed to look after people who have volunteered to work in reviewing reports to determine if they're technically correct. But I recognize what you're saying, and that's probably something that we should take a look at, because that isn't what the intent is.
Just to follow up, well, I think what Senator George was referring to is sometimes boards tend to get slanted one way. And so that somebody out in the field could be subject to a complaint by the board, of which then he would have absolutely no recourse, and the people on the board would be harmless, even though that they're actually acting under a political opinion more than an actual neutral position on what the geology report can and can't say.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, it's been a lot of work in the 10 years I've been there to keep focused on the report. I mean, that's what the board focuses on. They don't focus on political. There's been political pressure, but they're about what's in the report and the geology that the report is studying.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. Well, obviously there have been some concerns raised, and what I hope can happen is that you can look at some of these issues that were raised today, perhaps talk with Ms. Meyer and people who have raised the concerns and see if you can get some of it clarified. You might want to go back and speak with the people you talked with about the drafting and see if we can get it narrowed, and we'll bring it back.
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you so much for,
thank you.
For your answers to our questions. Anything else? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145.
and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 141. And Committee Administrator, will you please summarize Senate Bill 141 for us?
I'd be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 141 requires the Real Estate Commissioner to establish an escrow agent licensing system by rule, and it provides some minimum criteria for that system. It requires fingerprint and background check for initial escrow applicant, or when there's a change in ownership interest in that agent, escrow agent, or for corporate officers or individuals, in charge of operations. It allows the commissioner to require additional information from the escrow agent licensee or applicant. It grants some discretionary powers to the commissioner for the implementation of the licensing system. It allows the commissioner to impose disciplinary action for demonstrated incompetence, and it allows the commissioner to impose disciplinary action for an act of fraud or dishonest conduct substantially related to the applicant or licensee fitness, even if the conduct did not occur in the course of that escrow activity. It requires escrow agents to follow the written instruction of the principals to an escrow transaction, and it provides some clarity and updates statutory language.
Thank you for the very thorough introduction to Senate Bill 141. And we have...
Madam Chair, should I speak to the record on the dash one, or would you like me to do that as far as the technical?
Let me do that after testimony. Let's do the testimony first, okay. And then we'll talk about right. that. Let's have, it looks like Lori Skillman from the Oregon Real Estate Agency, please.
Yes.
Thank you. I hope I got your name right.
Yes.
Welcome. Could you state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laurie, L-A-U-R-I-E, Skillman, S-K-I-L-L-M-A-N, and I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. Senate Bill 141 is an agency-sponsored bill, and I have provided written testimony, and the written testimony is a section-by-section analysis of the bill. I will provide you a briefer oral testimony.
We appreciate that very much, Ms.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. Just as a way of background, this bill is a collaborative effort of the agency, the escrow industry, and members of escrow associations. We formed a collaborative working group of these individuals and the members of the board to look at our administrative rules, and as a result of looking at the administrative rules, the group also looked at our statutes and recommended some statutory changes. The real estate board reviewed those proposed changes, and the result is Senate Bill 141. A significant portion of the bill addresses housekeeping kinds of issues. And if I can sort of briefly state, there are probably six issues that the bill addresses. And the first is just dealing with housekeeping kinds of issues. One of the things that the bill does is to provide a number of different definitions that clarify the statute. And as we were looking at the bill, we found that there... At the statutes, we found that there were a number of very outdated and archaic language. So one of the things that we included was to allow for assignments of certificate of deposits, for example, to be used in lieu of a surety bond. That's a financial instrument that wasn't available a number of years ago. The second thing is that it takes the procedural aspects of escrow agent licensing out of the statute and requires the agency to adopt rules for those procedural aspects. All the other aspects of licensing, what the basic requirements for an escrow agent license are, remain in statute, but the procedural aspects are moved to rule. The third thing is that it addresses an issue we have with fingerprints and criminal background checks for escrow agents. Escrow agents, unlike a lot of licensees, we license a company. As part of an application, we require fingerprints on owners of those companies and people who are in charge of operations. So they're required to submit fingerprints at that time, so we can require them on application or at renewal. Well, there are a number of escrow agencies that change ownership in the middle of those licensing cycles. And so we have as part of the bill, we're going to require an application for a change in ownership that requires fingerprints and a criminal background check if there are new owners for the company or new people in charge of the operations. The third thing that it changes is, or the fourth thing that it changes is we have two new grounds for discipline of escrow licensees. One is that we can suspend or revoke a license if the licensee fails to maintain the required surety bond. The other is that we can take an action against a licensee if they perform what in the way that it reads in the statute, or untrustworthy acts within or outside the scope of the license. An example of that would be, because escrow, there are roughly 50 escrow agents in this state. They handle on the order of $80 billion a year worth of escrow funds in their trust accounts. So if an escrow licensee committed fraud, not related to the business, but because of the nature of the business that would directly impact their trustworthiness, then the agency could take an action against the licensee for that. And in addition to that, there's a new sanction of licensees. The only sanctions that we could impose were reprimand, suspension or revocation of a license. And now we're asking for a new sanction of reprimand, which is a lesser sanction. It was kind of going to the extreme. So we wanted to be able to work with the licensee and reprimand them without going to the extreme of suspending their licenses, suspending the business. And finally, the bill clarifies that not only do escrow agents have to have written instructions from the principals or written agreement from the principals, but they have to follow those. There is nothing in the statute that required them to follow those instructions. So in a way, that's kind of a technical housekeeping amendment, but it was pretty important. Again, all the escrow agents that we worked with, and we worked with 11 of them, so, you know, roughly 20% of the industry, on this bill, they were all in favor of it. They all were behind the bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Skelman. You'd think that the existence of the instructions would be implicit that they'd have to be followed, but I guess that it can't hurt to clarify that kind of thing.
Yes.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you for your testimony, and I have nothing but good things to say about escrow agents that I have dealt with personally.
Excellent.
They have saved my bacon more than once. But so you said there are only 50 escrow agents in the entire state?
Licensed agent. A licensed agent would be Chicago Title.
So it's a company versus
title.
An individual.
Exactly.
I see.
Yes, there are thousands and thousands of employees of escrow companies.
Thank you.
I have a question about, first on page 4, you have a couple of sections under, it's actually between lines 15 and lines 25, where you've added the clause, the commissioner may require additional information from the applicant that the commissioner considers necessary for protecting the public. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you anticipate might fall within that category of additional information that you wouldn't be able to get without that change in the law.
Okay. Madam Chair, that particular language is taken straight out of another part of Chapter 696, which covers real estate and escrow activities, and we have it for our other licensees. If you go to line 6 of page 4. This particular language was rewritten in part to modernize the language. That particular sentence that you addressed with the additional information that the commissioner may require, let me give you an example. Let's say we had a criminal background check on a licensee, and the criminal background check showed that there was a criminal conviction 10 years ago, and the language that we got back from Oregon State Police wasn't clear exactly what had happened, what the disposition of the case was, what the facts were. Instead of just denying them based on the report from the Oregon State Police, we could ask them to provide us with additional documents or a additional court documents that may have been filed with that, or if it was civil litigation, if they could provide us with the final judgment from the court, those kinds of things. We can only ask for the fingerprint card, and then we send it to Oregon State Police, and then they do a full background check on those individuals. So sometimes the information we get back needs to be fleshed out a little bit, so we ask them for that.
Thank you very much. And yes. Committee members, you may have in your file, you should have in your file, a letter from Ms. Skillman and Dean Owens dated January 29th that identifies some issues that have had come up in Senate Bill 141 and references an amendment. We did receive the amendment. It's a dash one amendment, but unfortunately we discovered after we received it that there is a mistake in it. So I'm sorry to say that we won't be able to consider that amendment today, but we will get that remedied. Do you want to speak to the amendment and the reason for the amendment, Ms. Skillman, and
well,
perhaps we'll get that on the record
Madam
now?
Chair.
Because I anticipate that the only change will be the typo.
Okay. You'd like me to speak to it?
Please.
Madam Chair, the amendment is extremely technical in nature, but basically what it does is on the bill on page 9 of the bill, starting on line 42, we added this language that made it abundantly clear that when an escrow agent disperses funds, documents, or property in an escrow, they can only disperse that under the terms of a written agreement between the parties to the transaction or written escrow instructions or an order of the court. Seems very straightforward. However, if you look at the existing language in terms of disbursement of property based on dated written escrow instructions, there is an exception to that in new sub 3. It's in line 5. It says, except as provided in ORS 314258. You can't close an escrow or disperse things without written instructions. 314258 was a revenue bill in the 2007 session, and it requires escrow agents to hold back from escrow taxes for out-of-state principals to the transaction so that the state is sure to get their money. So we're saying that you can't do this or do anything except for these written instructions, but the written instructions aren't going to say hold back my taxes, so there's that exception. Well, if you read that and then you read 9, there seems to be a conflict. You know, there's no exception in 9 for that. So we said, you know, how do we fix this? How do we clean this up? And basically, we cleaned it up by sort of deleting sub 9, since it's already a lot of the language is in there, except for the provision about a court order that allows an escrow agent to disperse funds, property documents by court order. So it's because there were exceptions in there and some of the language is already in there. Trust me, it took me 3.5 hours to figure out what is this? How does this work? Is this a conflict? And I wasn't quite sure, but legislative counsel said, yes, in fact, they determined there was a conflict. So it's merely to fix the conflict and not substantively change the bill.
Thank you so much. On behalf of legislative counsel, I apologize for the mistake, but this way we got the testimony out so we can, when we get that back, bring this back up again. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, just to clarify, that the language that we were just talking about isn't a mistake. It's just that the page reference
Correct. On
line 6 is wrong.
Correct. Right. It should be page 10, not page 11.
Okay. Not that I'm so smart, I figured that out. The capable committee staff pointed that out to me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm like a broken record this whole session so far, and here's what I'm concerned about. I'm finding a lot of business groups come in and bring in additional licensing requirements as a barrier to new entry. And the way the current law reads right now is that it's fairly objective criteria that's in state statute. What we're going here is a completely subjective criteria to the real estate commissioner to establish rules. And I get very concerned about that in as much as is that we're not just responsible to the industry. We're responsible to the ease of entry, and so that fees don't get too high. We don't have a small group of people who can charge very outrageous fees. So how, when we give this broad grant of authority to you guys to do this, how do we make sure that this isn't going to be used as a method to create barriers to entry into this industry?
Madam Chair, Senator George, the purpose of the bill as to the licensing section is to not change any of the fundamental requirements for an escrow licensee. For example, they'll still need the surety bond, they still need all these other kinds of things. But there was nothing, there were procedural matters. It's you need to submit an application form that looks like this. Well, that doesn't provide the agency with any flexibility on how to make the form look. So it is only those procedural aspects that are taken out. We cannot make up requirements for licensing in rule. We can only do what is allowed by statute. We can't say that you must be at least 50 years of age in order to be able to get an escrow license. You must, this or that idea. That has to be in statute. We can't make those things up in rule. The only thing that we're trying to do here is to put those into rule. And if I may, Senator George, through the chair, on page 3 of the bill, if you look at the very first line of the bill, all of that language that was taken out is a great example of what we're saying we'd like that in rule rather than in statute. It says, every escrow agent before engaging in escrow business shall file in the office of the commissioner an application in writing, verified, and in the form prescribed by the commissioner. The application must include the location of the main offices and all branch offices in this state. It's all that kind of procedural stuff that we were, to take that out and just say, here's what we need, and the form and content of the applications is, in fact, in statute. So it's laid out there that if we're going to have forms, here's what we have to have in them. What the form looks like, we need some flexibility about. That's the only thing. But I absolutely appreciate your comments, sir.
You've put my mind at ease, and I appreciate it. I got one quick little follow-up.
Sure.
I guess the word that actually caught my attention was on that page 3 of the bill, line 11, at a minimum. Meaning, and the way I read it was that this was that you guys, that the commissioner, through rule, could add additional objective criteria, not just have flexibility in implementation. And so I think you've put in the legislative record clear enough for me that you're going to stay to the statute, narrowly defined, and basically the flexibility we're providing to you is only in the implementation. And if, as long as that's the commitment of getting an understanding of that language, then I'm a lot more comfortable.
Very good.
And I think also, Senator George, that the at a minimum is modifying the system. That's about the system, so it seems procedural to me, at least.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Also have to testify about Senate Bill 141, Andrea Meyer.
Chair Bonamici,
member of the
committee. I'm our legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. This is sort of my day of, we just want to at least identify this issue and bring it to your attention. ACLU has been involved in, more than I've wanted, in the criminal history fingerprint background laws in the state of Oregon. And as the Senator Bonamici knows, because I testified this morning in Judiciary, we were involved in the masterpiece of House Bill 2159, 60 pages, in 2005, where I thought everyone was added to the fingerprint bill. So I feel like we're just a bit of a watchdog on making sure that the laws, as they're changed all over the statutes, remain consistent with some principles. And I simply wanted to identify that I appreciate the testimony of Ms. Gilman and the explanation of really just sort of reordering and cleaning up. I would note, I can't say I have a huge objection, but I would note that I think it expands it just a little bit here, specifically on page 4, where, if I am reading it correctly, the current law on lines 12 and 13 authorize it for individuals who have more than 5% ownership interest in the escrow agency and the corporate officers. Now, I understand the expansion is for people who join at a later time, but it appears from the new language on lines 1 through 5 that it would also include someone who is in charge of escrow operations. So sub A has more than 5% ownership, that's current law, and sub B, which is the corporate officer, which is current law. So I would just note it appears what may be a modest, although I'm not sure who this encompasses, an increase to those in charge of escrow operations for the escrow agent. So I leave it to you all. If that raises questions, I just, again, feel our role is to identify these issues and raise concerns when we see them and make sure that they're consistent with law.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Ms. Meyer. And I know, as we discussed it in Judiciary Committee this morning and have before, that it's my understanding that whenever fingerprints are collected for this purpose, that there are a lot of requirements regarding how long they can be maintained and how they're disposed of. So I see Ms. Gilman nodding her head, just to put that on the record, that it's my understanding that those procedures would be in place for fingerprints that are collected. But as you brought up this morning, now that they're digital, there's questions about that.
Chair Bonamici, the underlying statute to which they refer, ORS 181534, which gives a lot of authority. One of the things that we want to make sure, and I've actually seen legislation on the other side of this building introduced this session, which would be contrary to this, is that the fingerprints are destroyed either by the FBI, and they are required to have a policy of destruction, or by the Oregon State Police if they receive them back. We're talking about folks who are not in a criminal history database. Their fingerprints have not already existed, because if they do, they stay where they currently are. But we're talking about folks who have no criminal history, and if their fingerprints are taken, we want them returned and destroyed so there's no new database of people who have not been convicted of crimes. So that is an important safeguard, and that's not going to be present in this, because this ties back to the underlying statute, which then ties to significant rulemaking. The one concern, and you know, a little bit of what Senator George was talking about, leaving it to agencies, I have yet to figure out the solution to this problem, but what we tend to do with these is we leave it to agencies to decide we don't want a black and white line of you've had this conviction, you can't do this job. We need more flexibility. If someone was convicted of fraud with handling money, it certainly may not be appropriate for them to handle the bank account. Likewise, if someone was convicted 20 years ago of a small drug possession, that should not necessarily stop them from the job. So we leave it to a lot of the agencies to decide what crimes and sort of this nexus between their criminal history and the particular job. And that does put a lot of trust in the agencies, and I do need to pay more attention. I think some agencies have done a very good job of really looking at that, flushing it out, making sure that they've got a process there. Others in their draft rules have tried to leave it to a policy manual as to what crimes and what procedures, and that's inappropriate. So when we passed in 2005 2157, giving everyone under the sun, I think, the authority to do this, we need to go back and start looking at the agencies, licensing boards, and other folks to make sure that they've carried the spirit of the statute, where they were given a lot of authority in rulemaking to do this careful balancing so that people can continue to seek employment and be employed despite a criminal history if it is appropriate.
So, thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions?
And I think there's a fingerprint bill in almost every different committee. This
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, I'm going to just note that it looks like we will be getting an amendment and bringing this back to the committee.
The
dash
two, sir.
The dash two. Yes. All right. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 141 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 188. I'll ask our committee administrator to summarize the bill, please.
Madam Chair and the members of the committee, Senate Bill 188, it authorizes the Department of Agriculture to impose civil penalties for food safety violations. It authorizes the department to adopt rules to implement a civil penalty schedule, and it provides for a penalty not to exceed $25,000 for each violation. It clarifies penalty classifications in the statute, and it reorganizes a number of penalty provisions under relevant statutory sections. It amends a statutory provision related to livestock inspection violations to resolve a statutory conflict, and it makes that violation of the livestock inspection statute or related rule punishable as a Class A misdemeanor.
Thank you very much. And I have on the list, and I think you'd all like to come up together. Does that work? Lisa Hansen, Vance Bybee, and Sean Miller. Welcome, and thank you for your patience. I saw you sitting back there the entire time. So welcome.
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And with me, I have Vance Bybee, who is the administrator of our Food Safety Division, and Sean Miller, who represents the grocers. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about Senate Bill 188. This is an agency bill, and if it's acceptable, I'd like to just give you a brief summary of how we see the bill, and then we're prepared to go into it in detail if you would like us to do that, or just to answer questions. Senate Bill 188 provides civil penalty authority to the Oregon Department of Agriculture for those statutes that relate to our Food Safety Division. Those include meat dealers, the general food statutes that would govern grocers and food processors, labeling inspection of meats, the dairy statutes, shellfish bakery, locker plants, eggs, and non-alcoholic beverages. Currently, the agency has civil penalty authority in several other programmatic areas that many of you are likely familiar with, in our pesticide program, in our fertilizer program, our ag water quality program, confined animal feeding operation program, our seed regulatory program, as well as the Willamette Valley field burning program. In those programs, generally the maximum statutory cap is at $10,000. We will visit with you along the way about having this bill amended to be consistent with those other penalty amounts at a maximum of $10,000. And it has come with thorough discussion with the industry that we regulate here and the interest in having consistency across the agency programs. ODA has a philosophy around regulating about, first, we provide technical assistance and outreach and try to bring people along with compliance using the regulatory actions such as a civil penalty is our backstop. It's our last resort. And generally, we view it as when we get to that point, we may have failed in the process of bringing people along. So with that, I think I've explained that this amends all of the statutes, and the language generally is consistent throughout. It is modeled after the other statutes in the agency where we have civil penalty authority. And that was our thought process in bringing this forward. And we see this as another tool in the toolbox to enhance compliance in our food safety programs.
Thank you. And should we hear from the panel first and then ask questions? Anybody have any pressing questions? Okay.
You're
here for questions? All right.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of Senate Bill 188. And, initially when we looked at the bill, I was actually surprised that this was one of the, I think, few licensing programs that don't have a civil penalty authority. I do a lot of work on a lot of different licensing programs and was actually surprised to see that. And so we approached this and with our members, and I think the only concern that we initially had was that we keep the civil penalty authority to the 10,000 maximum, equal to the other licensing programs within the Department of Agriculture. So the specific amendment that I think we would request and have worked with the Department of Agriculture, which would be in all these sections, just change the $25,000 amount to $10,000. And we would obviously support the bill. Initially, we also asked the department of how the civil penalty authority would fit into the existing violations. Our food establishments take food safety very seriously. If you've seen the food safety book, it's a book of the size of a telephone book, and that's what every grocery store, anybody who handles these different, whether you have a bakery, a meat processing, or a retail establishment, you have to know everything within there, and you're inspected on that. So we take that very, very seriously. And we want to know how the civil penalty would fit into the current violations. For instance, when you have a violation, and ultimately our goal is not to have any violations in food safety. But if there is, our particular, our members are, they resolve them quickly and willingly and very fast. And so this particular bill, I think, is, and what they've outlined to me in a memo, is it would not be a new or replacement tool for addressing violations. It's simply, I think, to bring unlicensed firms into compliance, I think, is the main reason. And, again, those are folks that are competing with our stores that are licensed, are following the food code, and having their current authority, which is could only go through from a criminal standpoint, in this environment, I think is pretty unrealistic to even attempt to go after any of those folks who may be unlicensed. And so we obviously support the department's efforts in having this authority, being able to go after those unlicensed folks. But again, we would request the $10,000 maximum to keep it consistent with all other licensing programs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And I wonder if you could discuss briefly, perhaps I'll ask Director Hansen to talk about this issue has been raised as we've gone through the process of requesting the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements, that in some instances civil penalties are directed to the general fund with a budget note to send the appropriate amount of funding back to the agency. And this bill is not structured that way. This bill is structured so that the civil penalty amount goes directly to the agency. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and the history of your agency in the realm of civil penalties and whether this is consistent with other statutes that you have.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, When the agency requested the drafting of this bill, we modeled it similar to all of our other programs within the agency. And generally, the funds, when we collect civil penalties, are deposited into the Ag Services Fund. In some programs, those funds, civil penalty funds, are specifically directed for outreach and education. In this case, we had them generally coming back to the agency. Since the drafting of this bill, and actually in recent weeks, we've come to understand that Legislative Fiscal Office has had a policy that civil penalties should go into the state's general fund. This was a different policy than what we had dealt with previously. I think there's still some discussions going on currently within Legislative Fiscal and the leadership about how that should be handled, but ODA's intent was to keep this consistent with the way that we have traditionally handled these programs in the past.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may comment on that. Only, you know, we've done a lot of work in the Ways and Means process of actually trying to keep the Food Safety Division with adequate funding to be able for them to do the things they do. And I know in this budget cycle, and I know I'm not talking to the right committee, but I will have to say that $1.8 million was taken out of the Food Safety Division's budget. And so with that in mind, I'm a little hesitant of having some funding that could help support that agency go into the general fund, and so I just want to have that on record.
Thank you. And I, as much as I appreciate that, Mr. Miller, there's also a concern that's been raised about the perception of if an agency has the ability to assess civil penalties, that they will perhaps take enforcement actions when they're having budget troubles. And it's finding the right balance in terms of making sure that the program is funded, making sure that the civil penalty authority is there, and making sure that the perception is that they're the funding is going to the enforcement actions are being taken for the right purposes, and with absolutely no intent of disparaging the Department of Agriculture, it's a perception issue that has been raised. So we'll continue to work on that until we can get the fiscal impact statement and revenue impact statement. Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. I have a rather specific question, and it's always a thing with food safety, and that is pasteurized milk. You have a segment of the population that absolutely does not want pasteurized milk. Personally, I think it's a mistake to do that. But how will you address such things as pasteurized milk if we give you this bill, where there is a segment of the population which probably couldn't justify the safety of it, and if something happens in that arena, how will you address it?
Do you want to address the pasteurized milk and the exemption?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if this were to come into effect, and the way that we would implement it regarding pasteurized milk is to follow, as Lisa had said earlier, the same processes and procedures that we currently have in place. In Oregon, there is an exemption for the production of raw milk.
Can I interrupt you for just a minute? Can you please identify your name for the record?
Sure, I'm sorry.
It's been a while, so we just want to make sure that it's in there, that it's clear who's speaking. Thank you. Sorry.
My name is Vance Bybee. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division of the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you.
And regarding that exemption, if there is a farmer or a dairyman who would like to produce raw milk and they have three cows or less, two of them that are producing, then they can produce raw milk and it can be produced and distributed in the state. And so there are those who have the desire to do that and who are currently doing that. So it's not completely prohibited within the state. And so if there was someone who had that desire, I think that the first thing that we would do, as was discussed earlier as well, is the education process and to let them know that if they had the desire to produce raw milk, that there is a method, a legal method in the state by which they can do that.
As a follow-up to that, just for clarity, Lisa Hansen, for the record, generally the distribution of raw milk is prohibited in Oregon. It's the requirement that milk be pasteurized for human consumption, with the exception of this very narrow exemption. And some of you may have heard from constituents previously that would like the exemption to be broadened, and I think there is much public debate about that generally.
Thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a huge conflict of interest on this bill, but I think it gives me a little insight. I want to compliment the agency in your area. This, when your folks come out to our plant to do the their review, my entire staff views that they are absolutely team players and have been given great insight and are looked as more technical resources. And it is really, I got to tell you, the program from those who are being reviewed is very much viewed as an asset. And to have a regulatory body viewed as an asset by the business being regulated, it's a compliment to your agency. So I want to compliment you on that to start with. The thing the only thing that concerns me in this thing is for larger businesses, the $25,000 may not be a problem, but the new growth in Oregon and what we're investing in is people doing vertical integration from their farms and being innovative. And I know a lot of, in my industry, a lot of my new competition is in these startups that are doing innovative products at their farm in kitchens. And I worry about the size of the fines and whether that crosses over and perhaps takes you from a technical advice into more combative, especially with $25,000. So I wonder if you'd comment on Mr. Miller's comments about that $25,000, because for a lot of small businesses, that could be devastating.
Madam Chairman, Senator George, I understand your concern, and the agency understands your concern. How we have traditionally addressed this in the agency, there is a maximum civil penalty, and then within administrative rules, there is a matrices set up that takes into consideration the type of infraction, the cooperativeness of the operation in addressing the infractions, the number of times the infraction has taken place, to ultimately calculate the penalty that is given. And so in some cases, like in our pesticide program, there are some penalties that are as little as $200 in that range for licensing infractions. And so it really takes into account generally the public health impact, the environmental health impacts, and other things, the factors that make up how egregious the infractions are. I hope that's helpful.
And
the consideration.
Excuse me. Just to clarify, it's my understanding that the agency has agreed to the amending the bill to a $10,000 maximum, $25,000. Is that clear?
Yes. We would request that it be amended with the help of the committee.
Sure, go ahead, Senator.
This is a little far field, but rarely do I get the three of you on a panel, so I want to ask you a question. So I want to ask a very specific question. My biggest concern from a food processor perspective is in grocery stores with the bottle bill and the bottle bill expansion, the sugar content being brought back into the stores, which would never be allowed in a food processing operation. If I was doing what grocery stores are doing by having that product brought back into my food processing operation, I'd be shut down tomorrow. I am incredibly concerned about the amount of volume coming into stores of bottles and cans that have all kinds of feces and sugar contents and mice and all those things back into our grocery stores. My understanding is that the bottle bill exempts that portion from food safety regulations. Any alternatives on how to deal with that, Mr. Miller? I don't know if you could possibly. And that's my biggest concern, seeing that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator George, and just so the committee, I did not prompt him to say that question. but thank you for asking. But no, that has always been a concern of the grocery industry with the bottle bill and bringing garbage essentially back into your store. And I know with the recent adoption in January of expanding to water bottles, the industry has taken a pretty monumental step forward, where the beverage industry, the distributors and the grocery stores are working on expanding into redemption centers, and we are hoping to put redemption centers and start up this year going with a pilot project, you know, with that effort of hopefully eventually making higher redemption rates on not just bottles and cans, but a lot of other products, but getting them out of the stores. Because I know we've talked a lot in the past about the cost, and it's not so much the cost, it's the bringing them back into the stores, which I think is the biggest concern of the grocery industry. And you know, to answer the food safety issue, you know, we've always thought that it's been an issue, but I know it's essentially because of the bottle bill and its adoption, it's been one that most folks have just looked the other way, is how we felt. And it's not, I know it's not the Department of Agriculture's fault, but that's just the way it's been. And if we can move in a direction that gets it out of the stores and keeps the original intent of the bottle bill, which is getting these products recycled, you know, we're committed to that effort, and we'll be working through this year to get there.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I know there's been a lot of work done on that, and I believe there was a task force that's been looking at the redemption centers, and so thank you. Did you have another question?
I just wonder if the agency had any review of that at all. Concerns, I guess.
Madam Chair and Senator, Vance Bybee, again, this time you know who I am. We, unlike an industry, are tasked to implement all of the statutes that pertain to our agency, and so we have to work within the parameters of the bottle bill as well as within the parameters of food safety, and so we do our best to make sure that those responsibilities can live harmoniously. One of the ways that we have determined that they can live harmoniously is that generally the surfaces that those bottles may have contact with are non-food or non-food preparation surfaces, and so that there should always be a barrier between that those surfaces that may become contaminated with bottles and the food that is being purchased at a grocery store. It would be similar for, the same concerns would be equal for the children that you're putting in carts that probably are often dirtier than some of the bottles, and recycled bags that people are commonly now bringing into grocery stores, and other things would also have contamination. But the reason that we can live with that, or we must try to live with that, is because those surfaces aren't food contact surfaces.
Thank you. Senator Girard.
Thank you. I have to follow up on Senator George's question. I worked in a grocery store from age 8 to age 28, and it was real common to count bottles in bringing them back into the store, and then we would have to go back and trim lettuce or something like that. So the barriers that you're talking about, I think, are in a grocery store where you're dealing with consumption, I don't think exist. So I really think that I've always opposed any bottle bill expansion predicated on the fact that it's just a big health hazard. So I don't see where you... I guess I would just have to say I don't agree with your comment.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you all. We know that there will be an amendment on this bill, so we won't be able to move it today. One thing that I wanted to ask is that when you come back, if somebody could tell me what an avoirdupois ounce is, that's on page 2, okay. Line 43.
Actually,
and I don't speak French, so
right
I'm
now. Nice. Do we know now?
Mr. Bybee, would you like to?
I've been curious.
Yes, Madam Chair. It is a standard measurement. It's the most common international standard for the ounce. In comparison or in contrast with the troy ounce, that particular ounce that I'm going to refrain from saying because I don't speak French is based on 16 ounces to a pound, where a troy ounce is based on 12 ounces to a pound, and it's also very specific as to how many grains exist in that ounce.
Thank you.
A standard international measurement.
We're definitely going to put that in the learn
something
here
every day.
I was afraid we were heading in the direction of Freedom Fries.
Thank you, Senator. All right, I'm going to, is there anyone else here to speak on Senate Bill 188? No.
Thank
I'm going
you.
To close the public hearing on Senate Bill 188. And committee members, we have two bills on Thursday, both dealing with the debt collection industry, and those will be public hearings. And look forward to seeing you then. And I'll close the committee for today. Thank you.